Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series titled Advances in the Treatment of Diabetic Kidney Disease. I am Diana Isaacs, an endocrine clinical pharmacy specialist and the CGM program coordinator at the Cleveland Clinic Diabetes Center in Cleveland, Ohio.
And I am Natalie Bellini. I'm an endocrine nurse practitioner specializing in diabetes management with University Hospitals in Cleveland, Ohio.
And today we will discuss the latest developments in the treatment of diabetic kidney disease and strategies for preventing progression. To discuss more of this, we are joined by Dr. George Bakris, Professor of Medicine and Director of the Comprehensive Hypertension Center at the University of Chicago Medicine in Chicago, Illinois. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And let's go ahead and begin. So our first question for you is, if you could just tell us a little bit about what are the most common risk factors for chronic kidney disease or diabetic kidney disease?
Well, the most common risk factors are presence of diabetes that is poorly controlled, and along with that, hypertension that is poorly controlled. And underlying all of that is obesity. So if you have a family history, that's the chief genetics for diabetic kidney disease or any kidney disease, that puts you at higher risk immediately. And then if you have diabetes and it's poorly controlled, that puts you at very high risk, along with blood pressure not being controlled, magnifies the risk.
So when do patients with diabetes need to start monitoring for kidney disease?
ASAP. Basically, they need baseline data. So as soon as they've got a diagnosis of diabetes, they need a baseline diagnosis of kidney function. The patient needs to be empowered to be bugging the physician about their kidney function, because unfortunately, less than a quarter of people in the U.S. that have kidney disease know it, because the physicians have not told them they have kidney disease. So it's very important that if they don't hear about kidney disease, they need to ask about kidney disease. The physicians need to tell them about kidney disease. And the easiest way to do this is there is a thing called a heat map that the National Kidney Foundation put out and the international guidelines put out about 20 years ago now. And it's alive and well. And this is a heat map because it's got different colors. And it has the two fundamental components that need to be there to make a diagnosis of kidney disease, not just the estimated GFR, but also albuminuria, a spot albumin creatinine ratio. You need both those. If you only have one, you literally are not making a diagnosis accurately. So you need both, and the patient needs to know both.
Yeah, I have a feeling a lot of patients, unfortunately, don't know their values or aren't getting these tests done. Could you tell us a little bit about what the primary treatment goals are in DKD and how these goals vary depending on the stage and the severity of the disease?
The treatment goals are the same regardless of whether you have early stage or later stage kidney disease up until you have an estimated GFR below 25. At that point, they're still the same, but they get modified a little bit. And let me just be specific. It's very easy. Number one, you have to control the blood pressure. And the blood pressure must include, for control, a maximally tolerated dose of an ACE inhibitor or an angiotensin receptor blocker. Not low dose, maximally tolerated dose. That's number one. The goal blood pressure needs to be less than 130 over 80. Not 140, not 138, less than 130 over 80, properly taken, by the way. And there are guidelines for this. Number two, glucose control. Hemoglobin A1C must be reduced to less than 7. 8, 9, 10 doesn't count. You really need to be less than 7, or at the very least, 7. And then lastly, and importantly, up until, especially in the early stages of kidney disease, cholesterol control is important. Once you lose a certain amount of kidney function, specifically once you've lost more than half, cholesterol control is not as important for kidney preservation, and obviously it's important for cardiovascular preservation. So I think Those three things need to be kept in mind. And we now have additional medications that I'm sure we're going to talk about to help protect the kidney.
I think you're right. I think the hard part is for patients, it's a lot of different moving parts at the same time. It's to protect the kidneys, we need to control cholesterol, we need to control blood sugars, we need to control weight, we need to, and it just becomes overwhelming. Or we all think someone else is doing it, right? That's, oh, they're going to cardiology, they're going to control cholesterol. Well, the cardiologist isn't, they're doing this instead. You know, it's back and forth. And I think that becomes a challenge with the medical side. And so if the medical people aren't speaking, the patient doesn't know, and the communication is off, right? And I think that's a big part of it, too. CKD doesn't hurt. It doesn't feel bad every day, right, until it gets very bad. So I think that's another big challenge with it, is that in the beginning, nothing feels wrong.
One of the things that I tell the patients is, I'm sure you've heard, hypertension is a silent killer. Well, I have news for you. Kidney disease is a silent killer. And what they don't appreciate, and physicians, by the way, do not appreciate this, except the subset that have read the data, is once you've lost more than half your kidney function, your risk for sudden death, your risk for all-cause mortality, your risk for cardiovascular events goes up 3 to 10-fold, depending on which level of kidney function is. So the kidney, if you've lost the function, it's a cardiovascular risk factor, and it needs to be thought of as a cardiovascular risk factor.
Yeah. Well, I know we're going to get into the meds in a minute, but can you tell us a little bit about how diet and lifestyle modifications, exercise, how that plays a role?
There's no question. There's the two things I tell the patients are, in the diet, we can talk a lot about diet, but there's a four-letter word, and it is a four-letter word for you, the patient, that you need to avoid, and that's salt. And I give very specific instructions about salt. 2,000 milligrams a day, or one level teaspoon, is the maximum. If you're eating out, you're getting at least three times that, and you need to take possession of your life if you're eating out. How do you do that? Well, it's easy. You order fresh. You never get a soup. You never get lasagna or things that are ready-made, because they're already going to be loaded with salt. You avoid Chinese restaurants because they're going to be loaded with salt. They're salt palaces. So you really need to order a meal that's baked, broiled, or grilled, whatever you're going to get. And when you finish with the order, you say, please prepare it without salt. And I guarantee you, because I've tested this, if you do that, you will get the meal without salt. Then you can add pepper, you can add whatever you want. Everybody thinks no salt means no taste. Wrong. You can add all the condiments you want, but no salt or salt-containing condiments. Other things on diet is, once you have kidney disease, you do want to restrict, to a certain extent, the amount of protein you're taking in. So you shouldn't be having porterhouse steaks or, you know, things like that on a routine basis. And the recommendation, and it's a soft recommendation, but the recommendation is 0.8 grams per kilo. So if you're going to get a steak, that's fine. Get a 6 or 7 ounce steak. Do not get a 10 ounce or 15 ounce steak. And keep the protein low. And vegetable protein always is preferred to meat protein. The body, interestingly, can handle vegetable protein to death. You can drown the body in vegetable protein. Has no problem dealing with it. Meat protein, because chemically it's different than plant protein, the body has a more difficult time dealing with it. So it is easier if you use, I'm not suggesting you go on a vegan diet, but I am suggesting that you kind of switch over more towards a vegetable-oriented diet.
Interesting. Can you talk a little bit about exercise and the role that it plays in all stages of kidney disease?
So exercise is important because, number one, it'll help keep the blood pressure down. Number two, it'll help keep the weight down. Number three, it will improve your quality of life because you'll have better muscle tone and you'll be able to do more things, because one of the things that, as kidney function declines, people feel mopey, they don't have any energy and whatever. People that exercise don't have that problem or don't have it anywhere near as bad. And I'm talking about aerobic, not anaerobic exercise. I'm not talking about weightlifting. I'm not talking about push-ups. I'm talking about treadmills, swimming, the things that are going to increase your oxygen capacity and on demand.
I want to get into the drugs now. So I know back in 2021, finerenone was FDA approved. I know you've been very involved in the clinical trials. So can you tell us a little bit about the data with finerenone?
Sure, I can do that. But I think fundamentally as a teaching point, physicians and specifically non-nephrologists, although nephrologists know this, we never had anything beyond an ACE inhibitor or an angiotensin receptor blocker. We now have that. We have SGLT2 inhibitors, and we have finerenone. So we now, as nephrologists and endocrinologists, have transcended into the realm of heart failure cardiologists, where you have pillars of therapy. Heart failure, they have four pillars of therapy, and you have to use all four pillars to get maximal benefit. The nephrologist and the endocrinologist now have three pillars of therapy, finerenone, SGLT2s, and RAS blockers, and all three need to be used. And so finerenone is a compound that was 12 years in the making, where Bayer put all their chemists to work to come up with a molecule that would inhibit the mineralocorticoid receptor and not have all the baggage that spironolactone has. And so finerenone was born. Finerenone, by the way, has four brothers. None of them have been looked at in kidney disease, but they are being looked at in blood pressure. But finerenone is the only one that has a FDA label, a European label, and labels in Canada and elsewhere to protect the kidney and reduce heart failure risk. And the trials were a little unique, and I was privileged enough to head up the trials, and I picked a group of people to help me, which is a who's who of not just nephrology, but endocrinology and cardiology, to really look at these factors. So there were two trials, the Fidelio trial, which was in advanced diabetic kidney disease, and the Figaro trial, which was in less advanced diabetic kidney disease, however, high cardiovascular risk. And together, we set up the protocol so that it would be the same protocol, different inclusion criteria, so we could take all the data from both trials, put them together in a patient-level analysis, not a meta-analysis, but a patient-level analysis from the two trials called the Fidelity, which is over 13,000 patients. And what we found from that is, number one, we reduced progression of kidney disease significantly, and number two, we reduced heart failure hospitalization significantly.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I know they were added to maximally tolerated ACE inhibitor or ARB. The question I've heard from some people, what do you do if someone, their blood pressure is not elevated? So was everyone, in practice, should we be pushing people to get to that highest dose? Or if someone doesn't have elevated blood pressure, is it okay to use a lower dose of the ACE inhibitor or ARB?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. These studies were in hypertensive people requiring hypertensive medications. If you're normal tensive, or if you have no albuminuria whatsoever and are normal tensive, these data may not apply to you. That doesn't mean you don't control these things, but they may not apply. If these data do apply, if you do fit the criteria and your blood pressure is really well controlled, but you want to increase the dose of the ACE or the ARB, then reduce the calcium blocker. Reduce the diuretic so that you can do that. And people don't necessarily think about doing that, but that's the way to do it. And we did this, by the way, thank you for bringing this up. We did this because we wanted to make sure that we used the doses used in the outcome trials that made that class of drugs famous. Otherwise, using low doses is meaningless. And we know when you use low doses, in those trials, those people did not get a benefit. So another important point.
Can you talk a little bit about, how many in the trials were also on SGLT2 inhibitors and kind of how we decide like when to use the SGLT2 inhibitor or finerenone, or do we use them both together?
Right. Is it better to do a low dose of both of them? How do you clinically look at that person with diabetes and make that decision?
So now I'm going to regress or maybe progress to physiology to answer that question. If you look at all the classes of drugs that are protective of the kidney, all of them, RAS blockade, SGLT2 inhibitors, and finerenone, all drop GFR initially. And in the presence of diuretics, will drop GFR even more. So you don't want to give them all at once because then you'll freak out and you won't use them again. So you want to be methodical about it. So if they're on an SGLT2, if they're on a RAS blocker and their glucose is not well controlled, you clearly need to use an SGLT2. There's no question about that. But what if their glucose is reasonably controlled? Their glucose is hemoglobin A1C 7. They're already doing well. Do you need an SGLT2? Sure, you can add it, but do you have to add it immediately? Or can you add finerenone instead, especially if they've got some blood pressure issues or whatever? Because finerenone does lower pressure. Not dramatically, but it will lower it more than the SGLT2. So that's the way you got to think about it, and you add that on first. Then you can add the SGLT2, or you can add the SGLT2, wait about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and then add finerenone. What's the reason to add finerenone? You're not controlling sugar. I have news for you. You're not controlling sugar if the GFR is 40. You're getting nothing. So it's not a sugar question. It's a protection question. And this sequencing is important if your GFR is above 60, but it's not important if your GFR is 40. And so you got to pick your choice. If sugar is elevated, go ahead and add the SGLT2. It makes you feel good, even though you're not going to get much. But finerenone is a key if you have albuminuria. This is why you have to measure albuminuria. And it's a guideline recommendation to have a greater than 30% reduction in albuminuria sustained. So SGLT2s do that, finerenone does that, RAS blockers do that. And so you will get additive effects when you put them on and layer them. So finerenone, let's say you're on an SGLT2 and then a RAS blocker. You measure albuminuria. It's 300 milligrams or 250 milligrams. Add finerenone and you will get it down in the double digits for sure. I mean, we've had people with dramatic reductions, and I don't want to get into anecdotes now, but I'm just telling you that over time, there's additivity in the reduction of albuminuria, and that does correlate with better outcomes.
So that's really interesting. So it sounds like you're saying if there's albuminuria, both agents, ideally we would want to have both. It's a matter of kind of which one you add first, but we would want to have both agents added to the ACE or ARB.
There's no question. There's no question. It's just like in heart failure, you've got four drugs, and you think, well, these two are the most appropriate, so we're only going to use these two. Well, it turns out if you add the other two, you get better outcomes. So you need to do it. What you don't want to do is do it all at once.
Can you talk a little bit about the safety profile of finerenone, like anything we should watch out for? Does it affect, I know you mentioned it does lower blood pressure. Does it affect potassium levels?
Yeah, it does affect potassium levels. Based on the mechanism of its action, if it didn't affect potassium levels, one would be questioning whether it's truly the mechanism. So it does raise potassium. And in fact, the recommendation per FDA label is to start the drug up to a potassium of 5. Now, I think it's important to understand down to a GFR of 25. Now, by the same token, spironolactone is contraindicated at GFRs below 30. So the magnitude of potassium rise, this has not been studied head to head, but when you look at different studies at the same level of kidney function with the same background of diabetes, the magnitude of rise in potassium is far greater with spironolactone than it is with finerenone. And in fact, in the trials combined in the 13,000 patients, we had roughly doubling of the cases of hyperkalemia with finerenone compared to placebo. But only 1.7% of the 6,500 patients on finerenone stopped the trial because of hyperkalemia. So it was not a huge number by any means. And the other, by the way, because you asked the question earlier about SGLT2s and who was on it, We only had about 8% of the people on SGLT2s. But what was interesting is the people that were on SGLT2s that received finerenone had far less hyperkalemia. So interesting observation. If you're using all three, you get protection from hyperkalemia. Not that there wasn't any, because there was, but it wasn't anywhere near as significant.
That's interesting. So if someone's potassium levels are elevated, do you have any recommendations? I mean, other than stopping the drug, any recommendations?
If people's potassium level is elevated, this is the biggest problem in the teaching today. And I was taught this way too, and I've modified it. Is if you're on medicines and your potassium has gone up, there are two big things you can do if these are organ-saving, life-saving drugs, like RAS blockers, like finerenone. And what do? Well, obviously you can give dietary advice, and you must do that because a lot of people do overindulge, but you cannot depend on the diet. That is not going to answer the question. It'll help. It's not going to answer the question. What you can do is we now have potassium binders that are not only safe, the traditional potassium binder, SBS, has now got a black box. It's nobody's really recommending it from the FDA to be used. But we have two other agents, Pteromere and SZC, that work by different mechanisms, have been shown to be very safe, and both have got 1 year data of daily use with no problem whatsoever. Those agents need to be used in concert with these agents to mitigate against high potassium levels. We use them all the time, and it allows you to continue the agents that you're giving to preserve kidney function. This is very, very important. It's a culture change, but it's there. You need to think of it that way.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it is definitely a culture change that these drugs are so beneficial that we should add on additional therapy as needed to really reduce the potassium. So can you tell us a little bit about how you work together collaboratively with other healthcare professionals, maybe like dietitians, the PCPs, endocrinologists, kind of the whole team to manage the person with DKD?
So this is an excellent question, and it is a team sport. So nobody should be expected to do this by themselves. And in fact, there are programs now being developed in the country that are so-called cardiometabolic or cardiorenal. And you bring together the subspecialists, but really everybody's got to funnel with the primary care. And so the reality is, if you just have the nephrologist doing the kidney and the endocrinologist just doing glucose, it doesn't work like that. You really need to be aware of all of this. And if one doctor didn't do something, then you really need to do it. Now, there's too much information and there's too many things going on. So the dietitian is critical. So just to put the team together, the dietitian is critical to, and you really can't just meet once with them. You really should have one meeting and then have a reinforcement meeting, maybe in 3 or 4 months, maybe another meeting at the end of the year, just to crystallize concepts that you were told about diets. So that's number one. Number two, if you see that the patient needs to be on an SGLT2 and you're not an endocrinologist, you really, especially if the GFR is below 60, definitely below 45, feel free to start it, because you're going to start at a low dose. It's not going to affect anybody. Make sure it's a type 2 diabetic. If you feel uncomfortable, not a problem, send a note to your friendly endocrinologist saying, you know, the data is very clear that this will help protect the kidney and the heart, and I would like to start it. And there you go. Finerenone is something that is usually under the purview of the nephrologist, since most of those studies are out there, or the cardiologist. So either one should feel free to start it, because there's going to be a benefit to both the heart and the kidney. And the endocrinologist can start it too. There's nothing unique about us. Again, you know what's needed. You, the physician, know what's needed. You know what's been tried and true, what the guidelines say. And so therefore, you should make sure that the package is there. And If you don't, then somebody else is going to do it. But there needs to be a common knowledge amongst this group that all three of these drugs need to be on board. And how do we do this? And we don't stop these drugs. We give potassium binders if they're needed and they can't tolerate it because of high potassium.
So I love how you even describe like how, you know, the team should communicate with each other. What about PCPs? I mean, can PCPs manage this? Or I guess at what point should the PCP refer to these specialties?
And this is going to sound bad, but it's true. I've met a lot of PCPs across the country. There are PCPs that I know could handle this without any problem whatsoever. And then there are PCPs that after you got to square one, you need to start referring. And it's really based on not just knowledge, it's based on level of comfort, based on how they feel they can interact with the patients. It's a whole bunch of variables. And so PCPs can handle this, but that's a small number of people. And in general, I think they need to be integrating with the, at the very least, endocrinologist and cardiologist. But if you don't have a cardiologist involved, then at least the nephrologist. Because this information is in the bailiwick of all this, all these groups. And if you're not familiar with it, that's okay. It's an educational experience for you.
That doesn't sound bad at all. They're definitely, PCPs are capable of it. We just know there's a lot thrown at them. And so some will feel comfortable managing this, and others, it's great to have people you can refer out
to. To find the resource that's going to help you help your patient, right? That's really what this comes down to, right?
I mean, what really needs to happen is that, and I've been lecturing to primary carers and what have you about this topic, and a lot of them will get up and they'll say, listen, we know what you're saying is true. We know what we need to do. We have 12 minutes with the patient. And meantime, they're worried about their arm hurting and you want us to do all this other stuff. So our friends in the insurance industry, and I will even say the government, have put constraints on us to prevent us from being ideal doctors. And I will defend that in court, because that is exactly what's going on. And I'm privileged to have the time to do this stuff. Some of my friends at the clinic are privileged to do this stuff. But in general, that is not the norm.
I absolutely agree with you. It is tough to get to expect someone to do that level of medical management when you have 12 minutes two or three times a year. And that's it with no cancellations and no other problems with those visits. Right? You don't have an issue with a snowstorm in Chicago or a hurricane or anything else. It is three times a year, 12 minutes a time, you know? That's where the challenges start. So deciding that there is a cardio, find out where your cardiometabolic team practices. How do you get the person with chronic kidney disease the care that they need?
Yeah.
There's one final resource for patients, and that is if you go to kidney.org, it's a website, kidney.org. It's the National Kidney Foundation website. There is a patient portal there, and that is a gold mine of information on patient resources, on diets, on general information. And there's the second thing is there's an American Association of Kidney Patients. And that is another group that obviously isn't very much involved, focused on the kidneys. But guess what? Somebody's got to tell you got kidney disease first before you start doing any of this stuff. So we need to start the communication in the initial doctor's office.
Wow. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an amazing discussion.
Yeah. Wow, that was really insightful. And to think how much managing kidney disease has changed over the years. I mean, it's really unbelievable how we have therapies now. Just like Dr. Backris was saying, how heart failure has had all these therapies, we finally have that for kidney disease.
It is. And, you know, I think that we need to remember that in our lifetimes, 50% of people ended up with, you know, stage 4 or 5 kidney disease with diabetes diagnosis. And we have tools now to reduce that significantly. And I think that people have to get comfortable using them and working with a team. I mean, I think that was the big message that I heard again and again, was team.
Yeah, but I also really liked what he said about the silent killer, because I feel like there's been a lot of education about hypertension being the silent killer. But when it comes to kidney disease, like, no one's really talking about it. It's just kind of been this thing, well, oh, if you have longstanding hypertension or diabetes, you'll have kidney problems. But no one's talking about it. People either are not getting screened at all, like they're not getting tested for albuminuria, or they are, but no one's talking to them about their results. I mean, how many times have you seen a patient, you see that they've got albuminuria, and they don't even know like what that means. No one's told them. And so that's a big problem, that people have no awareness about this.
And it's a hard problem because for years they've had it. You look back in their charts and it's been years, and maybe they were told and they didn't hear it. And maybe they were, you know, I mean, we've all had those challenges as well. But I think that, you know, that's the first sign, is even just a little, okay, now what do we do? How do we change it? And now that there are treatments available to really address it, yeah. It's again, it's that same discussion of now is the time. Now is the way, you know, we went from diabetes is about high blood sugars to diabetes is a cardiorenal disease in one generation, you know? And so it used to be high blood sugars cause kidney disease. Well, it's also high blood sugars, high cholesterol, obesity. I could have listened to him for another hour.
Oh, I know. It was so good. But yeah, I mean, to that point, the guidelines have also really changed this year, the ADA standards of care in terms of the blood pressure management and the cholesterol. Right. I mean, it's really gotten more aggressive, like now with that blood pressure goal of 130 over 80 for everyone with diabetes. Before we had, you know, 140 over 90 versus some 130 over 80. And so I think it's good that it's streamlined, because, of course, that's another risk factor for kidney disease. And then also the cholesterol getting more aggressive this year with those LDLs down to 55, under 55 for those that have cardiovascular disease, and then under 70 for most people between 40 and 75. That's a big change. And
it's
that's
a big change.
Yeah,
right.
Going to cause us to use more agents to really be more aggressive with it, to reduce people's risk.
Right. I agree, absolutely. And now that there's data that shows that it actually makes a difference, I think that, you know, when we had, you know, the UKPDS and DCCT come out and say, we need to drive blood sugars down. This is our first, those were our first two big studies to say, we need to make a change. In the last handful of years, we've looked at cardiovascular risk, we've looked at other things and said, wait a minute, we're missing the boat here, right? I think this is sort of that cardiovascular now with DKD. Here we are. We have the tools, and we all need to be using them and working together. And if we're uncomfortable, we need to find and send the people that present with us with diabetes in front of us. If we're not comfortable as clinicians, we need to send them to people that are.
Yeah. No, that, yeah, he made a really good point about, like, when we asked him about primary care providers, like, right, they're brilliant. They can manage it. But the question is, are their systems set up to manage it? Right. And the good news is, if they're not, there's a whole other team members that can help. And I think that, I mean, that's a big part of healthcare, right? Relying on our team, figuring out, who do we have? Do we have the diabetes care and education specialist, the dietitian, the nurse practitioner, the pharmacist, the primary care provider, the endo, the cardio, the nephro? I mean, right? Like, we've got to work together, because it is, there's a lot of drugs now. There's a lot to manage. And we're talking about, you know, diabetic kidney disease, but people are people and have also lots of other conditions too on top of that. So it's a lot. But the other thing that I really liked about what he said was that really people should be on the finerenone and SGLT2 inhibitor, as long as their GFR is adequate, is over 25, to be on the finerenone. And I think that's important, because when we first heard about finerenone, a lot of it was, well, we'll use it, like, if they can't be on an SGLT2 inhibitor, they didn't tolerate it, then we'll use finerenone. And that's really, that's not what we're saying here. We're saying that finerenone reduces the risk, the cardiovascular risk. Also, SGLT2 inhibitors, they're additive. Like, you should be using both if you can. Maybe right. You add one before the other, but, like,
but
use
the timing,
them both.
Right.
If you care about your patients, like, you want to protect their kidneys, like, use them both. Use right. all the tools that you have.
And I think he made a really good point, too, of you know, when you start with one and add the next, it's not the next 6 months when they come back in to show up. It's 3 weeks later, right?
Yeah.
Don't wait too long. Don't, because now you're exposing that kidney to more damage, right?
Right.
And that progression continues to happen. So I thought that was a really great point of start this now. Let's give you 3 or 4 weeks. Let's get you to the next. And I think the pharmacist actually plays a major role in that discussion. I could see us using finerenone, having the patient check in with the pharmacist. You know, we do video visits with the pharmacist. We can do a face-to-face check-in and then say, okay, now it is time to do this. Here we are. Let's go to the next step.
Well, thanks. I like you saying that because what I'm hearing about all these different therapies is, of course, there's the risk of side effects. Right. But having a side effect isn't a reason to not use the drug.
Right.
And so to his point, yeah, potassium could increase, but there's a lot you can do about that. You can reduce dietary sources of potassium. That would be the best way. If not, there's other drugs you can use to help reduce those potassium levels. And it's similar also, I mean, with other drugs, with the SGLT2 inhibitors, with the GLP-1 agonist, we can give educational points to reduce those side
right.
effects versus just saying, okay, well,
that
guess it just
work.
Didn't work.
Right.
We're
right.
not going to use this protective therapy for you.
Right.
And unfortunately, once that happens, like once someone says, oh, I had stomach pain or I had an elevated potassium, it gets put in their chart, and then every other
as a
clinician
sensitivity, and then no one wants to touch
is
it.
Afraid
right.
to do it because it
right.
comes up on their allergy list. And
right.
so I think we have to be mindful about that. That's not a contraindication. It's not an allergy. It's something that can be mitigated through the right education. And so, yeah, we need to do that.
I absolutely agree. Yep.
Cool. Well, thanks again. This has been such a great discussion, such a great topic
I love
to talk
it.
About.
Right.